Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been a little more than a year since Humboldt State made the major name change to Cal Poly Humboldt, becoming the third polytechnic university in California. The move was made in part to meeting the growing demand for STEM and attract students to pursue an education in science, technology, engineering, and math on the North Coast. But as a result, the university says they're experiencing unprecedented enrollment growth, with a record number of applicants for this year's fall semester. And that surge of new students is creating a housing challenge. Because of a shortage of student housing on campus, the university announced plans this week for hundreds of students to live in hotels. The housing crunch is again raising longstanding concerns among students at the university. Joining us now to share more details into this plan are two representatives with Cal Poly Humboldt. Todd Larson is the Senior Director of Housing Operations and joined by Danielle King, Senior Director for Housing and Residence Life. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Vicky.
Okay, so Danielle and Todd, you both work for housing for the university. How are your roles different? Todd, I'll start with you.
All right. So I oversee housing operations and auxiliary operations here, so that's bookstores and dining, but mostly all the nuts and bolts and operations side. And Danielle is my counterpart, and I'll let her explain.
Yeah, so while he's handling all the nitty-gritty stuff, my role is looking at how we assign folks, looking at the customer service parts, and overseeing the staff who live in our areas, both professional and student staff, and support and provide resources to the many students who live on campus.
All right, so with that context, what conversations took place leading up to this decision from Cal Poly Humboldt this week? Todd?
Well, I tell you, the Cal Poly transformation has really come true. And with the expanded majors we added, we're seeing a doubling in our first-time undergraduate applications on campus, which is good for us. It's good for the community because the campus, as you know, has gone from a low of about 5,600 students currently enrolled to once was a high back in 2015 of about 8,500 students. We're on track with the Cal Poly prospectus and goals to hit about 7,500 students next year. So about another 2,000 coming into the campus. So,
can you describe the surrounding area in the North Coast that surrounds Cal Poly Humboldt?
Yeah. So we are based right in Arcata. And of course, we pull students locally from, you know, Southern Humboldt all the way up to Pasture Rica, Trinidad area. But university is the main, probably the main employer, main growth, main attraction here in Arcata. And so it's quite a driver for the community and the economy here.
Danielle, which students will be impacted by this change come fall semester, with some students potentially living in hotels?
Well, I think those are our transfer students and our returning students, which is why we, you know, took time to look at how we were, what direction we were moving in, to make sure that we could ensure that as many people as possible were able to have housing. It's not something we've done before. You know, we've traditionally had wait lists when we've had an influx in an enrollment population. And so we want to make sure that given the change in the community, that we could provide housing for folks who want to be here, who need to be here, and not have those folks on wait lists.
What is the rental situation like in Arcata and the surrounding area of the university? Because I know some upper-class students, after they live in the dorms, they may make some friends and move out and rent a home together.
Absolutely. And I'll say, you know, to Todd's point earlier, that, you know, we've had a larger population earlier on. Back in our 2015, 2016, we had our peak, but the community has changed. And I think that, you know, COVID had a lot to do with that. You know, students moved home. Places off campus in the community that were traditionally occupied by students, those folks left because no one knew what was going to happen with the pandemic. And when those spaces were vacated, we had permanent residents who moved into those spaces, and it really limited the options for our students. And so what has happened in the past, where while we had a wait list, students were still able to find housing in the community, that's a lot less now. Even with the addition of new apartment complexes, students still are having difficulty finding more housing now than they did back when we were at, you know, 8,000 plus capacity.
Hmm. So, Danielle, what would your messaging be to upper class or transfer students who maybe aren't so keen on the idea of going into a hotel room as opposed to living on campus?
Well, you know, I think our goal here was, again, to look at what is the best way for us to occupy a space that gave us the most availability of housing for students. But we also recently changed, you know, the messaging and are looking at what our returning and continuing students are asking for. And it's looking at their concerns. And we opened up our on-campus housing options so that both incoming students and returning students have the option of living on campus. They'll compete with both, you know, the hotels and the on-campus situation. But really, we've got a lot of really positive feedback from the folks who are currently in our off-campus bridge housing area.
Right. That's about 100 students, right? And I think what you were touching upon was that the university conducted a survey of those students who were staying in the Comfort Inn. What did those surveys say? What did they reveal about how satisfied students were with the living experience?
I think many of them felt excited about the idea of having this experience that they were sharing together, and I think it brought them closer as a community. And again, this is not going to be a perfect situation. There are many things that we simply can't do, and we're working to adjust, but they like that they have housekeeping. They like that there are Sunday dinners where they can get together and have, you know, some engagement opportunity with each other. While it's a short distance from campus, they still enjoy the fact that where they're located, there are still options available to them. They're near a grocery store. They're near other food outlets. And we work with a local restaurant, Peppers, in order for them to be able to use their meal plans at that restaurant so that even when they're off campus, they still have food opportunities. And all of the rooms have a microwave and a refrigerator. And they've got some things that, you know, the students on campus don't have access to. And I don't know how other folks feel, but having access to a pool and a hot tub is something that I wish I personally had. But it is one of the things that the students have noted as a benefit of living over there. Mm. But also the parking situation at the Comfort Inn is pretty good. They're not fighting for parking. They don't require a permit to have it there. And so if they choose to use the shuttle that we're providing or public transportation to get to campus, they don't ever have to buy a parking permit.
Mm. Okay, so that was going to bring my next question. I was going to ask Todd this, because this plan is anticipating, you know, roughly 350 students will be housed at three hotels, and that's the Comfort Inn, which we just talked about, but also the Super 8 Motel and the Motel 6, and that's in town in Arcata. And, you know, typically when students live in dorms, there's the option of meal plans as well as transportation not really being needed because students can walk. So what other further accommodations can students expect if they live in these hotels?
So what we've worked out this year really with Comfort Inn as our trial, and it's been a success, and we didn't know what it was going to be like, honestly. We were nervous. It worked out well. We had a few folks in the beginning decide to move back to campus, and they always have that option when we have space open up. But we provide shuttle service on call right now. We've launched that with our University Police Department and SUVs. That supplements the hourly bus schedules that go direct to the campus from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Meal plans are all available for the students. About 70% of the guests in the Comfort Inn right now are on a meal plan. And so that means they can just pick up food to go to eat wherever on campus, bring it back to their room if they want to save something for dinner or breakfast. The hotels have complimentary continental breakfast every morning also. So that, and like Donyette mentioned, the agreement with Pepper's Restaurant has really supplemented that for folks on that area. So we plan to add more shuttle service in the fall. Our parking services has been purchasing vans, and student driver programs will start up. And that's going to help have a little bit more on-demand commuter service for the residents there that maybe don't want to take the bus, or it's an off hour, or it's an after hours or early morning request.
In response to this announcement, there were some students who protested on campus. There's an online petition, I believe, that has gathered about 4,000 signatures demanding that the university change this policy. Now, the petition claims that some upper-class students have been excluded from reasonable housing options, believes that further actions need to be taken by Cal Poly Humboldt to ensure housing is equitable for all students. What is your response to those concerns, Todd?
Well, it's really interesting, and I have to share this with folks. You know, 3 years ago, prior to this, we were mostly a first-time resident campus. That's it. Your sophomore, junior, senior years, we coached people on how to rent off campus because there really wasn't much space on campus at all. We took a few hundred folks each year for continuing students on campus, and the rest was for first-time incoming, what we would call freshmen or undergrads, and first-time transfers, because we want those folks on campus to get situated, get to know roommates, get to know friends, potential roommates for moving off. So for the last 3 years, we've had low enrollment, we've had COVID, we've had a lot of virtual learning. So we had space in the residence halls to house a lot of returners. And so now that we have all our applications up, we're kind of back to a pre-COVID model, and we're back to mostly first-time students living on campus for that experience. And so it's a change. It's a change for returners. And they, you know, they were not happy that there was not enough space on campus. So through working with all the students and meeting with all of them, we've added back an option for up to 600 spaces for returners and transfers to work with on campus. And so that's going back to sort of what we used to do. And then so primarily first time on campus, get that experience. And then we'll take a few with returners. We also have special housing for students with disabilities. They can go through our Student Disability Resource Center, get priority housing on campus. The same thing with some of our athletes that need to be here on campus for practice, things like that. So there are exceptions that are made for campus housing, and there's a process for that too.
Given that this is really, this approach for fall semester is bridge housing, because there's going to be new housing facilities that will be available, which is if it is on schedule for fall of 2025. So this spans like one school year between this gap. How many students will this new housing accommodate? And is that construction currently scheduled to be completed on time come fall of 2025?
Yeah, many folks in the area probably were familiar back when we were trying to build the Village Project in Arcata. And we worked several years to get that approved, and it would have been up and running and open by now, actually, for housing. But we had differences with the city of Arcata, and it just didn't plan to fruition. We dropped the project. We started over once the state bought the land over at the Craftsman's Mall area. And that project is scheduled to be on track. At least half of the units are supposed to be online by fall of 25 and the other half by January. That's going to be just over 960 beds for upper class housing. They're full apartment style housing. And in addition to that, we have two more projects on campus we're working on that will add more housing for freshmen and upper class. And those are scheduled for 26 and 27 openings.
But given the university had record applications, why not limit enrollment until the university had completed construction of the new housing facilities?
That's a very good question. Part of it is our process of trying to meet our enrollment numbers. At 5,600 students, the campus, you know, we're not paying the bills very well. It's just not keeping up. And so we needed to get up to our funded level of about 7,600 students to really start earning what the chancellor's office has funding the campus for, because we've been overfunded for many, many years. And that funding was going to be pulled unless we get our enrollment back up. So that's one of the goals. The other is we launched a lot of these new majors, and the interest has just been overwhelming. You know, with fire science and cannabis work and biology and wildlife. So there's a lot of new College of the Natural Resources students coming in. And the projections have just exceeded, I think, you know, what we were looking for.
And if I can just add to that,
please, Danya.
I think that the Cal State University system is about providing access to folks who may not have thought that they could, or, you know, weren't able to be supported in a way where they could attend college. And if you meet the enrollment criteria, if you meet the admissions criteria, we want to accept people who meet those standards. And so really our goal is not to turn away folks who are looking to receive a college education, but instead to figure out what do we need to do in order to manage the needs of our campus to be able to support and provide access to those students.
Right. And as enrollment increases, I mean, I think some projections from the university are that enrollment can increase by 50% within the next 3 years, 100% within 7 years. So there are some other options that are being floated around for temporary housing. I believe one of those ideas mentioned in the university's announcement is floating apartments or studios. Does this actually mean student housing is going to be literally floating in Arcata Bay?
That's a
like
good
they're
question.
They're in housing boats, or
yeah, we've looked at a variety of options. We've looked at other larger hotels. We've looked at floating accommodations that would be in the harbor, and it would probably be more in Eureka Harbor, not Arcata. But nothing's been confirmed yet. We're still working on what the best options might be to supplement the 350 beds we're going to have over on Valley West in Arcata.
What conversations are you having just among the Cal Poly, Cal State community? Because when it comes to emergency and temporary housing and housing insecurity for students, I mean, this is across the state. We have, you know, designated parking lots at times here at Sac State for people so they can sleep in their cars. I mean, this goes all the way down from Southern California to the North Coast. You know, how will the university ensure that there's going to be enough stable, secure housing for students to meet this excessive growth? Todd?
So a couple of things. One, we have an off-campus housing department that helps connect people with landlords. We launched a really groundbreaking, humble tenant landlord program that educates students and landlords locally on how to raise standards and understand what the needs are. So that's been very helpful. The other thing is we've had an emergency housing program in place for several years now on campus. And we house, you know, at a minimum 8 students at any given time for up to 21, 20 days. And that runs through our Dean of Students and our CARES office. And so students can apply for that for emergency housing if they're in between something or a domestic violence situation or whatever it might be where we want to take care of them. It's interesting that on campus, we probably have recognized, I think, about 16 students right now that have registered to live in their vans or their RVs in parking. And we support that. They're allowed to park on campus. We have showers, lockers, mailing services. We have a commuter lounge in the student lounge center also. So those are just some of the ways that we're trying to help support emergency housing.
Donyette, is there anything you want to add before we wrap up?
I just want to make sure that it's understood that, you know, we work with our student population and try to connect with our AS and other folks to make sure that we're answering the needs of our students. We're listening to them. We're hearing what they're asking for. And as we are moving forward with this bridge housing option, it's making sure that we are sensitive to their needs and finding ways to address those needs in the best way possible. We don't want for this to be a situation where students feel that they've been, you know, disenfranchised. So we continue to work with them to make sure that they feel safe, they feel secure, and they've got access to the resources similarly to what our students on campus have.
Donyette and Todd, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Vicky.
Thank you.
Todd Larson is Cal Poly Humboldt Senior Director of Housing Operations and Auxiliary Services, joined by Donyette King, Senior Director for Housing and Residence Life. Also, an editor's note to pass along, Cal Poly Humboldt holds a license to KHSU, which Cap Radio operates. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. These findings likely won't come as a surprise because either we or someone we know are going through this. Within the past decade, overdose deaths, depression among youth and adults, as well as anxiety has been on the rise across the country and California, which has only been accelerated during the pandemic. The need for behavioral and mental health resources is greater than ever, in large part also due to a shift in a collective awareness and acceptance. But that only goes so far. California's behavioral health workforce is struggling to keep up with the demand as the expectation from the state to provide these services continues to grow. Counties across the state have a behavioral health agency, which typically serves low-income residents with serious mental illness, substance abuse, or a combination of both. The association that represents California's county behavioral health departments commissioned research to better understand this unmet need that is only expected to rise. That report was published this month out of UC San Francisco. Janet Kaufman is a professor of health policy at UCSF and co-author of this research. We're also joined by Michelle Cabrera with County Behavioral Health Directors Association. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Yes, thank you very much, Vicki.
So, Professor Kaufman, I want to start with you. We're going to dive into the new research in just a moment, but you've been researching the state's healthcare workforce for more than 25 years. How have conversations and really the focus on behavioral and mental health changed in that time?
So, great question, Vicki. You know, I would say that really it's been in the last maybe 5, 6, 7 years that there's really been, I think, a shift to greater attention to the behavioral health workforce and its needs. We did our first really comprehensive report on this in 2018, and then were invited by the County Behavioral Health Directors Association to work on this report. So yeah, I think there's been, you know, an increased focus and increased, I think, recognition of how important mental health is to our overall well-being, as well as recognition of just the increased number of people who are struggling with either substance use disorder or mental health conditions, or sometimes both.
Right. And your research found that 1 in 5 adults in the state has a mental illness, and this spans from 2018 to 2019. And about a quarter of these adults had unmet needs that you're talking about for mental health services. But that actually goes up to an estimated 64-65% of adolescents with major depression. This can be kind of a chunky question, but how do people typically access behavioral health care?
Well, I mean, they can do it in multiple ways, but often, I would say often people first come to their primary care provider, you know, particularly if they're having physical symptoms. And then, you know, where they go from there in some ways depends on their type of, you know, insurance. Some people, particularly the people that the county serve, are lower income people who will go to county agency, either to community based organization that contracts with the county, maybe to a federally qualified health center, depending on their need.
When we're talking about this workforce,
yeah, Michelle. Let's let Michelle add some texture here.
Hi, Michelle with the County Behavioral Health Directors Association. I mean, I think this question about when people seek care and how is really fundamental, right? So we often talk about help-seeking behaviors. Does the person have awareness that there's a need or a desire for help in this way? And then do they know where to go, where to start in accessing that? So for individuals with private insurance, as Janet mentioned, they might start with their primary care provider or reach out to their health plan and get a directory or a list of providers who might be taking their insurance or not. Or they might just sort of open up a directory and go in search of a provider who may or may not be covered under their insurance plan. For people with Medicaid or Medi-Cal in California who are low income, there's a robust set of benefits that are covered across the continuum and provided either through their Medi-Cal managed care plan, or in the case of individuals who have more significant mental health needs or need for drug treatment or alcohol treatment, they can access that through the County Behavioral Health Agency. And, you know, connecting them to those services often comes either because they've touched the system in some way through an emergency department visit or a visit to their primary care provider, or in many cases for people with serious mental illness and substance use disorders, we're actually affirmatively like going out into the community, doing outreach and trying to connect people back to our resources through public awareness efforts, et cetera. So we really seek out our clients as much as we try to be there for our clients when they seek help out with us.
Given that you lead the County Behavioral Health Directors Association, many may not have heard of this association. Who do you serve?
So our members are the department and agency heads for the various county behavioral health safety net agencies. And counties are in the role, as Janet mentioned, primarily of serving individuals with Medi-Cal with specialty needs. but we also provide kind of a broader safety net in the community. So oftentimes we do touch people with private insurance or no insurance at all, because we are safety net providers with that expertise in mental health and substance use treatment.
So given, Michelle, that on the one hand, there's obviously more awareness, there's more acceptance on a societal level, but also through policy, governments, healthcare systems have been investing in behavioral health. How has this need grown over time, especially for the counties that you represent?
Well, a few things are going on, and I think you covered it really brilliantly at the beginning, right? So obviously the pandemic sort of ushered in an awareness, a conversation, but it also triggered conditions, right? So individuals who turned to alcohol or maybe drug use in that time, you know, we know that you spiked during the pandemic. And also for many people, the isolation, the lack of social connection, and other conditions related to the pandemic, such as grief from losing relatives, really deepened anxiety, depression, and other conditions. And that was all sort of sitting on top of a cultural moment societally, where, as you mentioned, folks were starting to sort of develop a language around mental health. And some of the stigma has started to peel away. I wouldn't say that we're all the way there yet, but, you know, there's start, and we especially see this among young people, right? Young people who really, I think, are far ahead of some of the adults in their lives in being able to identify that they may have needs and articulate that they want that kind of help. You know, in prior generations, no one might recognize it, including the child or youth themselves, until they were much further along in their development. Mm-hmm. So that is both exciting, but it's also sort of caught our system at this moment when there's so much disruption happening because of external factors, right? Telehealth has really revolutionized our systems in the last several years, but there's also a ton more market competition, and we're trying to expand the types of services that we are asking of the public system at a time when, again, the resources from a staffing perspective really aren't there. So there's a lot of shifting happening as increased demand is going up.
Okay, so Professor Kaufman, let's get to your research. The report is broken into 6 parts. It spans, you know, roughly 80 pages. What are the main conclusions that you want listeners to understand?
Right. So I think one of the main, you know, conclusions is the county system is really really struggling. We did one part of our research was a survey of Michelle's members, and many of them are really, you know, struggling with recruitment and retention, really across the board. You know, some professions like psychiatry, especially challenging, but across the board. And we asked them, well, why are you struggling? What do you think is, you know, driving this? And competition, I think, number one. You know, and Michelle laid this out beautifully. The counties are, you know, competing with Kaiser, with private practices, and, you know, and also competing with school districts. I mean, I think that's not always appreciated, but for youth, for child and youth behavioral health, school districts are an employer, and counties often really struggle to offer competitive wages. And so given where we are right now in California with, you know, high inflation for many things, and especially our struggles for housing. I mean, you highlighted the challenges of affordable housing up in Humboldt in your previous segment, and that's true across the board. So I think that's it. And then, you know, not only the traditional, you know, competitors, but, you know, we've seen all of these telebehavioral health startups that are, you know, not only maybe paying better, but also offering a lot more flexibility than we've traditionally offered. And also, I think to some extent, you know, because those are services that people access on their own, maybe, you know, accessing, you know, you're serving people who really are seeking help. Whereas, as Michelle noted, a lot of her members' work is going out and engaging and trying to get people ready to be treated. Mm. One last thing I'll say is that we do see in behavioral health that there's a segment of the workforce that doesn't accept any form of insurance. I'm not talking just that they don't accept Medi-Cal. They don't accept private health insurance. They only do, you know, a cash business. And, you know, you will find, you know, these folks say, you know, Marin County, other wealthier areas. And they're certainly serving people with needs, but the fact that they are in a cash only practice means there are fewer psychiatrists, fewer marriage and family therapists who can serve those folks who cannot pay out of pocket for services. And that's most of us in California.
You know, what you also found that I found interesting, because we're talking about counties that serve some of the most vulnerable people, but this workforce historically does not reflect the diversity of the state, and there are language barriers at play, right, Professor Kaufman?
Yes, we found that the majority of staff in the county agencies and the majority of behavioral health professionals in California overall only speak English. Certainly some speak Spanish and other languages, but particularly I think for Asian languages, there's not a good match with the population that our counties are serving.
Yeah.
And I think just one last thing on languages, and I think, Michelle, you're aware of that in some of your counties, that, you know, even where you've got maybe, you know, a complement of staff who speak Spanish, we are increasingly seeing folks of Latinos in California whose first language is an indigenous language, say for Mexico or Central America. And so, you know, there's very few providers who speak those languages and are able to talk to those people in their primary language.
Right. And Michelle, it's not only languages. When we talk about diversity, I mean, it's race, it's ethnicity, but it's also sexual and gender identity as well.
That's right. And one of the things that I will highlight is that, you know, we are drawing from the pool of education and training that exists. And I think Janet's research showed that we do a really good job of recruiting individuals who are as diverse as we can, given that pool. But certainly one of the things that we're sort of trying to highlight and uplift is that there are policy levers that we can pull to increase and improve the racial, linguistic, and sexual orientation and gender identity of the workforce so that it better matches the Medi-Cal population. This congruence between providers and the patients that they serve arguably is far more important. These preferences around cultural background, language, and understanding than it is for other kinds of healthcare, right? Because the nature of the work is that you're getting more personal with these providers, and that understanding can really make or break a clinical and other relationship where confidence is really important.
Right. And Michelle, this is also coming at a time when, you know, we have, you know, Governor Newsom's a care court, which is taking effect this year. And you served as a member of the Governor's Council of Regional Homeless Advisors. I mean, given that the County Behavioral Health Safety Net, which primarily serves low-income people, you also go out and conduct outreach. How does this growing crisis further strain the challenge of helping people? And are there other initiatives, although well-intentioned, that are contributing to this challenging forecast?
100%. I have to say, I never thought I'd see the day when, as a health policy advocate, I would, you know, groan when a new initiative was put on the table, because as much as we want to do these things, there's this massive cloud hanging over our heads. How are we going to do it? Where are the people going to come from, right? And how are we going to make progress in recruitment and retention quickly enough to do the great job that we know we can do when we are fully staffed up, right? And so one of the things that I'll highlight is that the nature of the work that the safety net performs oftentimes is field-based, right? And as you mentioned, you're working with some of the most complex, most vulnerable populations. And the expectation from the public is that we're there 24/7 and out in the streets and in people's homes. Recruitment for that kind of work in 2023, when people have the option to use their education and training to be at home in their computer, on their computer, you know, it's just, it's really tough. And we empathize with sort of both the professionals who say, I have options and I want to do this work from home, but also the needs of the clients are that we are out in the community. And there are folks who are passionate about doing that community-based work who would want to do that, mm-hmm. right? These are solvable problems, Vicky. We've been here before in terms of workforce challenges. But we, you know, we really need to make those investments both on the education side. And one of the things that our members lifted up and that Janet's report reflects is that the schools need to train people to do some of this field-based work in different ways, right? Not to train people for that private practice, cash pay type business. And we need to be ready to offer competitive salaries so that people get a living wage in California.
You know, Michelle, I mean, in the last minute or two that we have left, I mean, the whole goal of this report and research was to craft a 10-year strategic plan. Where do you see an opportunity for immediate headway?
Well, in the immediate, we really are calling on the governor to not delay the proposed investments from last year's California budget. The governor pulled together an ambitious and significant package of healthcare investments to expand those educational slots, to invest in increasing the pipeline. And because the economy appears to be softening, there was a proposal to delay it in the governor's January budget. We're really calling on the governor not only to not delay those investments, we really can't afford to because of the governor's other priorities, but to double down on those efforts and continue to expand on them, because we won't be able to really follow through with the governor's ambitious agenda and the legislature's unless we make those investments.
Professor Kaufman, I want to end with you. You hosted a webinar on these findings earlier this week. A couple hundred people showed up. What does that signal?
Well, I think that signals that there is a lot of interest and concern, you know, that I think a lot of folks are, you know, aware of these governor's initiatives, want them to succeed, want to learn more about this workforce. So I personally am hoping that signals a momentum to persuade the governor to, as Michelle says, double down on behavioral health workforce investment so that we can really realize the vision of providing everyone with good access to mental health and substance use disorder services.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kaufman and Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Janet Kaufman is a professor of health policy at UC San Francisco, and Michelle Cabrera is executive director of the County Behavioral Health Directors Association. They're discussing a new report out of UCSF diving into California's behavioral health workforce shortage and what the state needs to do to meet the growing need. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. If the NBA season were to end today, the Sacramento Kings would be in the playoffs. The team, which is now on break for All-Star Weekend, has 32 wins and 25 losses, perched in third place in the Western Conference standings. If you're a casual fan or maybe don't even follow the Kings, you may wonder why this is significant. Just think about all that's happened over the past 16 years in Sacramento since the last time the team made the playoffs. The Kings almost moved to Seattle. Capitol. There was a ballot measure to build a new arena, which failed. The Kings were sold, and then the city and a new owner agreed to build Golden One Center, which gave birth to DoCo, the downtown commons area. And the Kings have had more head coaches than anyone really cares to count. Players constantly coming and going, all in the hopes of getting back to the playoffs, making this team and franchise relevant again. And we are now just a few weeks away from ending the longest postseason drought in all of the four major professional sports. So that's why we invited Fox 40 sports reporter and producer Sean Cunningham back to Insight to talk about the team's success so far, what it will take to get to the playoffs, and why this success means much more than basketball. Good morning, Sean.
What's going on, Vicky? How are you?
I think I needed sad music under that intro.
Setting
up the past 16 years.
It's definitely uplifting, right?
So you last joined us October 18th. That was the day before the beginning of the season. And at that time, you were cautiously optimistic for everything that I just laid out, that the team would have a decent season. But then the Kings, they got off to kind of a bad start. They had four straight losses. But fast forward to today, the Kings have already won, I believe, more wins than all of last year. They also have two All-Star players, and they're in third place in the West. So what do you think? How do you think things have been going so far?
I mean, if you're a fan or even a media member covering this team, you're thrilled with the team's success thus far, even if it is just regular season success and other teams wouldn't look at this and getting ready to, you know, be too excited to throw like a parade or anything like that. I mean, this is something that just hasn't happened here in Sacramento very often, as you laid out. And because of that, fans are really, you know, I was cautiously optimistic about this team because, again, you haven't seen it in a long time and you kind of want to see a little modicum of success before you get too excited. You know, they always say the proof is in the pudding and you just haven't seen it yet. Now you're starting to see it. I mean, you mentioned just a minute ago, De'Aaron Fox and Domas Sabonis are both All-Stars teammates, Sacramento Kings. That hasn't happened since 2004. And there's so many of these moments throughout this season already, and we're only 57 games into the 82-game schedule. So with 25 to go, I mean, every night it seems like they're doing something that we're saying, oh, we haven't seen that since this year. We haven't seen this since this year. These little like landmarks that of accomplishments that have happened. And when you really look at it, it's even bigger than that, Vicky. I mean, the league is taking notice of the Sacramento team. That they play a fast-paced, efficient brand of basketball, especially on the offensive end. There's certainly plenty to pick apart and be critical of on the defensive end, but here you are going into the All-Star break, right? You've got Fox and Sabonis in the All-Star game on Sunday, but you also have a rising star in Keegan Murray, the rookie, who's going to take center stage on the Rising Star Challenge on Friday night, along with Kevin Huerter in the three-point shootout. So Sacramento, you're talking about four of the five starters represented at All-Star Weekend. You also have an Uber Kings fan and a Davis native in the celebrity game in Hassan Minhaj. So Sacramento is well represented, and I got to catch a flight tomorrow to head to Utah myself to cover it all.
You've been covering the Kings for quite a while. You're a Sacramento native. How long does this go back for you, journalistically speaking?
Yeah, I like to say like in the NBA before they had the one and done where you had to go to college for 1 year, I was right out of high school into my profession, just like LeBron James. So, it's been since 2002 was my first full year. I had a taste of it in 01, but 2002, if you remember, Vicky, that's the that 01-02 season was the pinnacle of King's success here in Sacramento. They went to the Western Conference Finals and, you know, brace yourself, Kings fans, because every time you mention that, everyone thinks of the Robert Horry shot and getting bounced by the Lakers and three zebras, as they like to call them, the NBA's officials. So, that series ended in heartbreak. It was the closest they've ever had. It came to a championship, and it's the most success they've ever had. So that's when I started, and everything else has kind of been gradually downhill since then as they work their way back to trying to reach those heights again.
Yeah, and here we are more than 20 years later having this conversation, and, you know, it's been a rough ride for longtime Kings fans like yourself and covering this over the past 16 years and counting. But has there been a more dysfunctional or even drama-filled team in pro sports like this before?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there is. I think it gets this small market town has been through a lot, and a lot of their warts show over the years. But there's plenty of organizations that have had really awful things that have happened to them. And I mean, if you look at just in the NBA alone, if you were comparing it to something like, you know, the Donald Sterling situation in the Clippers, I mean, that certainly you haven't had anything criminal, you know, or just grotesque like that. And there are things that have happened along the way that, you know, some people like to, you don't like to see the way the sausage gets made. And certainly seeing an organization, almost a city, almost lose their only professional sports franchise is frightening. So fortunately that didn't happen. And you've got not only a team to still root for civic pride, but you have that beautiful arena in downtown Sacramento that acts as what, you know, Vivek Ranadive, the owner of the team, has he set out to see this arena and that Doco Plaza to be this modern day cathedral, if you will, to bring people together of all walks of life to be able to celebrate something. And that source of civic pride. So certainly it's on the up and up right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that opening. I was there. I covered it back in 2016. And you mentioned, I mean, we're now getting national recognition like ESPN. Can you give us an example of a small market team, or what began as a small market team, like perhaps the Kings, who has found success, and really how that impacts the culture, the morale, and the spirit of a city?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, in talking to people just throughout the years, they always look at, I always joke because, you know, college sports don't really resonate in California like they do in the Midwest or the South or, you know, other parts of the country. But when they come to Sacramento, the way the team is supported by the fans and the way they're supported by the fans is very similar to the way major college sports are supported by these rabid fan bases. So I like seeing that for sure. It is a small market. You can see sustained playoff success no further than a team like San Antonio, who gets a generational talent in Tim Duncan. They have a great coach in Greg Popovich, and they're able to rattle off several decades of sustained playoff success. And here they are now just getting their first taste of losing basketball in a very, very long time. So I think that's always been the model for not just NBA teams, but particularly small market teams. And when you're looking at a team like the Sacramento Kings, yeah, it was 16 years, but even in a 16 year playoff drought, even before that though, they, you know, they had several great years of sustained playoff success under the Maloofs and Jeff Petrie, who put that team together, and Rick Adelman, who had that head coach. So every team has to go with, you know, you're hoping for continuity. You're hoping for a similar message that sticks around for so long. And, you know, let's face it, it takes talent. So this team has gone through many iterations of talent. You know, Sabonis and Fox will be the first All-Stars since DeMarcus Cousins. So that's a long time. So but when you have 16 years of a playoff drought and lack of success, it doesn't usually you don't usually get your stars rewarded that way. So once you start winning cures all, and that's when you get your not only the national media taking attention, and you get the likes of national TV games, but you also get, you know, some of these merit badges along the way, like All-Star games.
You know, you mentioned that you started covering the Kings, you know, like when you were a young adult, an older teenager. What would you tell a 16-year-old fan now who has never even witnessed the Kings in the playoffs? I mean, how do you think that experience is, what it's going to be like if they actually accomplish that this season?
Well, I don't know if you saw the NBA Finals with the Warriors just down the road, or even the Milwaukee Bucks before that, but the way the arena is set up, you'll see these people who gather in the plaza and don't even have tickets to the game, and they'll gather and watch outside the big gates of the arena. And I can imagine that for a first round playoff series, not even the NBA Finals, Vicky. I mean, that we're just talking about the first round of the playoffs. I mean, the NBA postseason is 2 months really of basketball trying to reach the NBA Finals. So I think that's how rabid the fan base can get. I think that if you've never been to an NBA game in your life, Sacramento is one you want to have on your bucket list. And I say that not only because of just the environment there and the atmosphere for a game, because this is a team that'll, you know, sell out on a Wednesday at, you know, 7:30 or 7 o'clock at night. And it brings, you know, people a reason to gather and to have fun at these venues. But it's a unique arena, because you can literally have a seat all the way in the nosebleeds. You pay maybe $5-$10. I don't know what I think $12 for a seat up way up in the nosebleeds. You don't even have to go to your seat. You can go and stand on the concourse with a better vantage point, or in the beer garden, and have an absolute beautiful view of NBA basketball for such a cheap price like that. So no other place in the country when it comes to the NBA can do that. So if you ever have one of those seats way up there, you don't even have to walk up and sit in your seat. You can just watch it from the concourse.
All right, Sean, I have three words for you to wrap up. Light the beam. Okay. What's your reaction to that?
Oh, man, it's fun. It's always fun to see something like that happen so organically. I talked about, you know, Malik Monk having that eye injury and he had the Band-Aid and the fans were showing up to arenas with the Band-Aid because he was playing so well and he didn't want to take it off. And then you get this light, the beam that just comes out of nowhere. And you've got this big beacon of light from the arena that shines. If no one's seen it, it's big purple, looks like Samuel Jackson's lightsaber from Star Wars. And it's unbelievable. It's a lot of fun that the fans get behind. And yeah, every time they win, they get, whether it's on the road or here at home, they get to light the beam. And they even have another one. How about the defensive player of the game chain, this big like amulet piece of jewelry that's like blinged out. It's pretty fun, and the players get behind it, and that's kind of the fun thing about this is like the it's like a connection the fan base has to this current crop of players, and it's a lot of fun for them to be able to share that.
Well, Sean, thanks for joining us, and I hope come June we have good things to talk about.
Absolutely, that would be amazing.
Sean Cunningham is Fox 40 sports reporter and producer. Thank you for the time, and go Kings. That is it for Insight today. We'll join you back live on Tuesday because we are off for the President's Day holiday. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Tuesday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.